The Senate Agriculture and Veterans Budget Division will come to order. First thing on the agenda today, we're going to look at the budget review from the Agriculture Utilization Research Institute. If they would come forward, and we will start as members will be coming, but we want to get done and get out of here as quick as we possibly can. So welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I am Teresa Spaeth, Executive Director of the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, and I have with me here today Dan Lemke, our Director of Communications. You should have a packet of information there with the AURI folder in front of you, and what we have in there is an outline of our information that we'll be presenting today.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as you may be aware, 20 years ago this year, the Minnesota Legislature had a vision for the future of Minnesota agriculture. They created the AURI to foster value-added benefits for our state's commodities. And for over 20 years, this committee has supported AURI in its mission to foster long-term economic benefit through the identification and expansion of markets for new or existing commodities, ingredients, and products. Also, the development of new uses or value-added improvements for Minnesota agriculture commodities and the development of ag-based renewable energy opportunities. How do we fulfill this mission? One way is that we provide scientific technical assistance. We do this in three locations across greater Minnesota, in Crookston, Marshall, and Waseca. These facilities provide R&D, applied research, and technical feasibility to businesses in the countryside where the assistance is most often needed. In addition, we conduct proactive, value-added initiatives. These initiatives are designed to provide greater Minnesota emerging opportunities in value-added agriculture, as well as encourage them with the latest trends. Another way is to provide targeted network coordination that brings the best expertise Minnesota offers to greater Minnesota. Our project development directors work directly with growing businesses and emerging entrepreneurs to foster implementation of R&D in areas where the most benefit can be realized on the countryside. We do this by integrating both technology and resources to promote sound decision-making and product advancement for businesses promoting value-added ventures. Over the past year alone, we assisted 168 projects, providing over 20,000 hours of technical and scientific assistance directly on the countryside. Science and technology are crucial to AURI's operations. We are pleased to offer these services in greater Minnesota in three of our locations. This includes a fats and oils laboratory in Marshall, a USDA-certified meats laboratory also located at our Marshall facility, a co-products utilization laboratory in Waseca, a product development laboratory in Crookston, and a microbiology and fermentation laboratory also located in our Crookston facility. Who typically receives services from AURI? Farmers and farmer-owned cooperatives, small and medium-sized agri-processors, and emerging ag-based businesses. These organizations rely on AURI's professional staff to foster best decisions and best practices to increase utilization of Minnesota commodities. Not only do business owners benefit from AURI's services, but we also work strongly in partnership with our collaborators to bring forward emerging trends in value-added agriculture. These partners include commodity and grower groups, farm organizations, state and federal agencies, universities, and private and public organizations. All of these work together to contribute to Minnesota's success in value-added agriculture. How do we identify specific projects and initiatives within these categories? Primarily, each year, AURI conducts an in-depth stakeholder analysis with our commodity groups, farm organizations, economic development organizations, and commodity businesses. These help us yearly to set our priorities, ensure collaboration among the organizations, identify industry trends, and assist in initiative development. Examples from this year's stakeholder analysis include projects that involve DDG utilization for the corn growers, biodiesel quality on behalf of the Minnesota soybean growers, biomass gasification in northwestern Minnesota on behalf of the wheat growers, DDG utilization in pig diets on behalf of pork producers, and glycerin in poultry diets on behalf of the Minnesota turkey growers. Here with me today to discuss a few of those impacts, because impact is the most important thing on value-added ventures, is Dan Lemke, our Director of Communications.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Teresa mentioned, everything we do is designed with impact in mind, impacting Minnesota producers, the utilization of Minnesota-grown commodities, and impacting rural communities, which is precisely what our organization was formed to accomplish. Over the past year, projects that we've been involved with have directly impacted over 20,000 Minnesota farmers. It's quite a good number, and we're very proud of that number and the fact that the work that we're doing is not just being done for the sake of having research done or having projects brought forward, but it's to directly impact the farmers and the growers here in the state of Minnesota. Those activities have brought forth planned and actual infrastructure investment and facility construction of over $211 million to date, and there's certainly more planned and on the way. Because, as we mentioned, a lot of our mission is to create and retain rural wealth and rural economic activity in the farming communities of Minnesota. The funding that AURI has been provided, we are also able to leverage over $2 million in outside funding, some from federal sources, others from our commodity partners on a project-by-project basis to help maximize the amount of resources that AURI has been given. Annually, we also conduct a survey of the clients of the folks that we've worked with to see if the services that we're providing are beneficial and we're offering the right thing. Just in a couple snapshots here, some of the things that they've reported that among the most important things that they were able to do with the assistance of AURI and our collaborators were a number of them did create new jobs. They created new opportunities in rural Minnesota. The vast majority, however, said they were providing benefit to rural Minnesota and opportunities for Minnesota-grown commodity utilization and Minnesota producers to add value to what they already raise. Now, the primary area that AURI was able to assist was in product development assistance. That's one of the things that makes AURI a unique organization are the lab facilities and the pilot plants where Minnesota companies come in and work directly with us to test the feasibility of manufacturing a product, of process refinements, and developing those new uses for the commodities, the leftovers, if you will, and all the Minnesota-grown commodities that are there at our disposal. So, again, the primary focus has been on technical assistance and providing help directly to those opportunities in Minnesota. Over the course of AURI's history, the whole entire climate of value-added agriculture has changed, and primarily the last number of years, renewable energy opportunities have certainly been at the forefront of activity in Minnesota. That is certainly an AURI priority issue is for energy utilization and co-product utilization as the ethanol industry, the biodiesel industry, and other renewable energy enterprises develop in the state of Minnesota. Most of them also have co-products or leftover products, and we're very actively involved in trying to help develop uses for those products, creating additional revenue streams for those enterprises in Minnesota. Commodity utilization, obviously, given the resources we have, we try to get the most bang for the buck, utilizing the largest amount of commodity possible in a value-added way so that our producers are receiving as much benefit as they possibly can. Animal product processing is certainly a priority area as well. As most of your commodity folks will tell you, the grain producers, and one of the most important things for them is a healthy livestock industry in Minnesota, and we concur with that and try and do what we can to help processors and help value-added opportunities for animal products as well. We also try to maintain a staff that has expertise that is relevant to the needs of Minnesota and laboratory and facility capacity that also is non-duplicative and provides much-needed services out in rural Minnesota where our offices do exist. As Teresa had mentioned earlier, we have in the past year worked on about 168 different projects. Among those are ethanol co-products as fertilizer, testing one of the leftovers from ethanol as a fertilizer, possible replacement for some of the commercial fertilizers as the ethanol industry grows. That's a co-product that may have some additional value. Now, these client-driven projects are very important to us and are very vital to bring forward new uses, and a lot of ideas are brought forward from these clients. Another project that has been key for us is working with the pork producers and working with the University of Minnesota on increasing, evaluating, I guess, increased inclusion rates of the distillers' grains among pork diets. See how that impacts their production, but in our case, testing primarily what that means for pork quality and whether or not that's a product that consumers are going to want, and see how that all shakes out. Utilization of glycerin as Minnesota's biodiesel industry grows. The main co-product there is the glycerin. As we've increased the production and the amount of glycerin out there, the price has greatly diminished, and most of the plants that are producing it are currently looking for ways to maximize the value of that product. We have a number of projects going in that area to try and find out ways that we can add value to that product at this point. Compost barn initiative, one of the things that is happening in the dairy industry among smaller to medium-sized producers is a different style of housing and caring for dairy herds, utilizing what's called a composted dairy pack barn. Many of them use wood products, but as the cost of transportation increases and as the supply tightens for wood products, we're evaluating different agricultural resources that could be used in place of that media, and providing an opportunity for these producers for utilization of a lower priced raw product that can help in their facility. We worked with another example is a company called Compostomat, where they are actually producing a corn stalk based hog mat for use in farrowing and nursery facilities, replacing rubber mats both from an animal comfort standpoint and from a pathogen control standpoint. These biodegradable products have about a 7 to 10 day lifespan, and if any of you have spent time around hogs, you know that's probably about as long as most things would last in there with a group of pigs, but that's exactly what they're designed for. It's biodegradable, made in Minnesota, and that provides an alternative for the Minnesota pork processors and for utilization of corn stalks in the state. As we mentioned, the animal processing industry is very important, and we've worked a number of different areas with the Minnesota Association of Meat Processors and individual processors on things such as shelf-stable meats. Our meat processing facility in Marshall has tested and produced a number of meat products and transferred that technology to the meat processing industry so that they are able to produce products that are not only safe but also have a longer lifespan on the shelf. Several years ago, AURI applied for and received some federal funding from the USDA, and we created a Center for Producer-Owned Energy, as it's called, and as the name implies, it focuses on developing farmer-owned renewable energy enterprises here in the state of Minnesota. We've been able to use that funding as well as AURI funding and our partner funding to help bring about the development of over 20 renewable energy enterprises here in the state of Minnesota, everything from biodiesel to biogas to biomass utilization. We were able to leverage funding about 20 projects directly impacting over 7,500 farmers here in the state of Minnesota. So we think that's definitely an example of an effort that works. That federal funding did sunset. It ran out. We utilized basically all of it at the end of 2006. We're certainly looking to continue that Center for Producer-Owned Energy program because it was very successful, and obviously it's a hot topic right now here in the state of Minnesota. But we've also used that center to collaborate to a great extent with a lot of other folks here in the state through a couple initiatives called the Bioenergy Roundtable and Action Now initiatives, bringing together over 40 different organizations of state agencies, institutes of higher learning, private entities, basically providing a one voice for bouncing ideas off and keeping aware of trends when it comes to renewable energy so that all of us are aware of what's going on and are collaborating and working from the same songbook, essentially. A couple of examples of projects that have been brought forward through the Center for Producer-Owned Energy is Ottertail Ag Energy, which is an ethanol plant up in Fergus Falls, not only producing ethanol but also utilizing some of the co-products in a brand-new product project, rather, to reduce some of the natural gas and some of the other fossil fuels that are needed for their process. We've also worked with Central Minnesota Ethanol Cooperative, for example, in Little Falls with their gasification unit on their ethanol plant, where they actually will be using wood co-products, wood waste, but they also have the potential to utilize the distiller's grains from their own facility to gasify that and offset some of the fuel costs that they have at their facility. We've done a great deal of work in biodiesel utilization, both in very large engines and in small engines. We had a project with the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association and Arctic Cat, where they actually tested one of the first biodiesel-powered small engines. We had some ATVs that ran around the state and were tested, and biodiesel performed very well in those applications. On the flip side, we've worked on a project with utilizing biodiesel in Mississippi River tugboats. So you're talking kind of both ends of the spectrum, and in both applications, the biodiesel fared very well, and we're hopeful that that provides some new markets and some opportunities for biodiesel and for the folks in Minnesota that produce it. Northern Excellence Growers I was not aware of this, but Minnesota is one of the larger grass seed growing states in the country. Up near Lake of the Woods, there's almost a microclimate that's very beneficial, very conducive to growing grass seed. There's a number of growers up there that raise grass seed for the industry, for commercial markets. However, as they harvest and process those seeds, they end up with a lot of chaff, a lot of waste. Primarily at this point, it has been hauled to a landfill and burned, or they may have actually had to pay to get rid of it. We've tested with them through the gasification process using that raw commodity, that leftover essentially, to be gasified, create a synthesis gas, and it worked very well. They're still in the process of pursuing whether or not they want to actually put in the gasification unit, but it has the potential to actually create enough power to power the whole town in which that facility is located. Granted, it's a very small town, but still, it's a pretty cool story to be able to talk about an agricultural co-product powering almost an entire community. And then, as is another very popular topic right now, is cellulosic conversion to different sorts of biofuels. There is a group in southwestern Minnesota that we have had a great deal of work with where they are looking at utilizing primarily corn stover through a conversion process to make gases, and at some point could actually go all the way to ethanol. But at this point, it's still in the development stage, but it's certainly something that has a lot of interest throughout Minnesota, and we've been involved in that particular project along the way. At this point, I guess I would like to turn it back to Teresa to close out our presentation.
Thank you, Dan. We hope to share with you some of the ideas and some of the accomplishments that we have made, especially over the past year. As many of you may be aware, renewable energy is everywhere right now, and that's one of the most promising value-added opportunities for greater Minnesota that we've seen in a long time. But there are also many other opportunities in bio-industrial products as well, so there's a lot to be done. Minnesota was a front runner in creating opportunities in value-added ventures 20 years ago when our organization was created. However, we need funding and support for these opportunities to maintain at current levels. AURI state support, as you may be aware, was cut in 2003 from $4.2 million a year to $1.6 million a year. That was a devastating blow to our organization. It resulted in staff cuts and layoffs, an office closure, and some of the services that we previously offered were cut. However, through the course of our USDA grant and some other opportunities that we've participated in, we have been able to maintain services, and we are very happy with the accomplishments that we have made. To give you a little bit of background, our current operating budget for this current FY07 year is $3.9 million. We were able to achieve that by the utilization of the state dollars that we receive, as well as the federal opportunities that Dan mentioned earlier. However, those opportunities sunset December 31st of 2006, and we once again requested opportunities at the federal level, but as I'm sure you're aware, we're unsure of where that is going right now. What we have requested this year from the legislature is restoration of our funding to the pre-2003 level, and that would be $4.2 million a year over the biennium, for a total of $8.4 million. And we intend to utilize that with the priorities that we have set and discussed with you today, as well as some new opportunities that we see on the horizon. Renewable energy will continue to be a very, very important subject across Greater Minnesota and the state as well over the coming biennium. But there are new opportunities that we see emerging every day, and we intend to utilize those funds to make sure that Greater Minnesota generates the wealth, creation, and retention that is necessary to be beneficial. So we do thank you for your support. And if you have any questions, please feel free to let us know.
Ms. Faith, you were cut 1.6. Am I reading this right?
Yes, we were cut per year.
That's
from 4.2.
From 4.2 to 1.6.
Per year.
I guess what I'm, I'll go from policy to budget now.
Pardon?
I'm going to go from policy to budget now. This is
okay.
The budget committee. I know what's going to go on here. The big word up here is renewable energy. Cellulose is on everybody's mind, but I'm not so sure we all understand how you get to that point. I think that it looks to me like you're going to be very busy.
Absolutely.
Maybe you're busy already, but you'll be busier.
Yes.
So, members, stop, think a little bit. Maybe we need to try and restore some of this cut to keep you going.
Thank you.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Mr. Chair, could you tell me about the West Minnesota wheat grower biogasification? Is there something going on up there? New business of some sort?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I have with me here today Michael Sparby. He's the project development director in charge of that project. Oh. And maybe he would like to comment just a little bit about the progress that has made.
Thank you.
We don't do anything with this bill, do we?
Mr. Chair, Michael Sparby. I believe the Senator Ingridson, the project you're referring to is biomass gasification in northwestern Minnesota in conjunction with the Minnesota wheat growers.
Yes.
That is a feasibility study, a broader scope feasibility study that will assess, look at the opportune feedstock within the region, match that up with the opportune user of that gas produced, and drill down and look at something site-specific and be able to do a technical as well as an economic feasibility for that. It has not been done yet.
Okay, so it's in the early stages.
Exactly. Yep.
One more question. Follow up, Mr. Chair. I was visited by somebody with regards to this the other day with regards to wheat stock. There hasn't been a whole lot of talk about that, but I understand that's a pretty good product for working in this area. Is that what we're talking about here, wheat stock?
For straw?
Straw. That's
yes.
Right.
That project actually will look at multitudes of feedstock. So it'll be wheat straw as well as the potential of corn stover in the area or in the region. We're looking at partnering with the Minnesota corn growers in addition to the Minnesota wheat and barley growers, the grass seed growers. Again, as Dan had alluded to, up in the Roseau, Lake of the Woods, Marshall County, ryegrass straw is very abundant in the area, and there's no current market for the ryegrass straw. So that is something that begs to be looked at. So the feedstock potential is great. But getting back to your initial question of wheat straw in gasification, yes, it is a very good product for gasification. The only issue is the silica content within the straw that has to be dealt with through the gasification process.
One more follow-up, if I can. Then, just a rumor then that possibly in the very northwest corner of the state of Minnesota is where this may be going on. If this were to become a real-life thing, the economy up there is certainly struggling and looking for something like that. Is that rumor, or is that something that's really being looked at?
That is something that is really being looked at through this process, as with the Northern Excellence Project. There are three grass cleaning facilities, the Northern Excellence in Williams and two other facilities in Roseau, or in the Roseau vicinity. And those would also be excellent places for gasification units in the sense that they have the waste product or the screenings available for the gasifier.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for your presentation, and we will take a look at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you.
Scoy has three bills, and then he has, I don't know if he has to leave for another committee, but we'll, okay, then why don't we just go right down, I'll take yours one at a time, and then we'll be done. Senator Scoy, and the first one is Senate File 133.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I finished my commitment in the other committee. I've had that bill hearing, so I don't have any time constraints, but I appreciate the opportunity to hear these three bills. First is Senate File number 133, and Mr. Chair and members, I do have the A1 amendment to Senate File 133.
Senator Scoy, would you like to put that on the bill so it's in order you want it? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment brings the bill in line with what the Board of Animal Health's request was, what is included in the governor's budget.
Senator Scoy moves to amend Senate File 133 with the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order that he'd like to present it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill should be ready, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 133 is a continuation of the bovine control effort that the state has started last year. As most of you or many of you would know, we did have a bovine TB outbreak in the cattle herds up in the northwestern part of the state. The Board of Animal Health has been working with the USDA and the Cattlemen's Association and the cattle producers in that area to manage and get this under control in the cattle herds. We are making progress there. We will have some ongoing costs for this next biennium that this bill deals with. I will just briefly tell you that we think we're making significant progress and hopefully have this under control in the cattle herd. We still do have bovine TB in the wild deer herd that is presenting us some challenges, but the DNR is currently in the process of instituting a deer population control effort in the affected area, and they are actively working to enforce the feeding deer ban that we instituted last year. I certainly appreciate your support on this bill. I do have a letter from the Bankers Association. David Skilbred is here if you have any questions of him of support of this bill. I'm here with Linda Glazer. She's a senior veterinarian at the Board of Animal Health to help explain what exactly the appropriation is for.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Vickerman and members of the committee. The funding that was put forward in the governor's budget is to support the TB eradication effort, primarily for personnel, both in northwestern Minnesota to continue the testing, and staff at the central office for managing the information related to the investigation, and the equipment and supplies needed by those staff to carry out those activities. There's also funding to contract with private practice veterinarians to do some of the testing as accredited veterinarians as well.
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Clavin is here from the Cattlemen's Association, if you had any question of them.
Senator Scoy, I think we know exactly what you want to do and what we're trying to do here, because we've started this before. I think the important thing is hate to say this, but I'm going to keep it up north because we don't want it down south. I got enough trouble. So anything we can do to take care of that so it doesn't get. And the deer herds, that's for a different committee to figure out how that's going to work. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. It is extremely important that we act fast and that we act aggressively to keep this bovine TB, if not, I mean, I don't even want to say the word isolated. I want to say eliminated. And so we've been working hard to get it eliminated from the cattle herd. I think we've made a lot of progress there. We are now working hard to get it out of the wild deer herd.
Senator Scoy, I went out to Washington, and I took a letter that you gave me and turned it in to the congressman out there. It has to do with appraisal. For some reason, the federal government thinks a cow is a cow. And that might be true unless you got a cow that you got a $4,000 pedigree that you put there. So I left it after your request and asked them to take a look at that, see if they could prove that it was one they had papers on. It should be worth a little bit more than just a cow. So I was able to do that, and they were receptive of that, and I don't know how that's going yet, but I thought it was a good idea, and I took it for you.
Appreciate you delivering that letter for us, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, just a point of interest. Was there money expended on this program last year? Or the last biennium, I mean?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, there was.
I'm sorry, I'd stepped out. Do you know how much that was?
Mr. Chair and members, I actually do, because I think this bill, as originally was drafted, was what the appropriations were for the 06 and
07.
5 and 06.
06 and 07.
06 and 07. So the 408,000 in 06 and 408,000 in 07. Now we're heading off into the 08 and 09 years.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Scoy, I said earlier, I think we all know what the bill is. It just needs to move the money as we move along. So what's your wishes?
Well, Mr. Chair, assuming that you're going to be carrying the funding for the Department of Ag in the governor's request in an omnibus bill, if you are, that's a fine place for this. Otherwise, we can move this to the floor and move it on its own, whichever is your wishes.
Senator Scoy, my preference would be pass it and we'll lay it over here for inclusion in our big budget bill that we end up with later. That would be my suggestion. If that's what you want to make that motion, I can do that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate file number 133 be...
As amended.
Be laid over for possible inclusion in the agriculture omnibus bill.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. Senator Scoy, you have another one.
Mr. Chair, I would like to do Senate file number 496 next. I think Mr. Schoenfeld. Is here to help me with this. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 496 is a bill appropriating money to the county and district agriculture societies. These are the county fair organizations that we have across the state. This is an increase from what they received in the last year of approximately $100,000. These payments would be distributed based on the exhibitors and participation at the county fairs. As you know, members, the county fairs are the feeder networks that provide exhibits at the state fair. Minnesota is proud of its large and very successful state fair, the wonderful community gathering that we had every late summer, early fall in this state, and I think it's important that we assist the counties in providing good quality exhibits to our wonderful state fair. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Schoenfeld to give you a little more detail about the nature of this request.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
State your name for the record.
Senator Skoy. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I'm working today with the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. And the appropriation that goes to county fairs is a longstanding one. It goes back, I think, to the first territorial legislature, actually one of the first bills they passed started the jurisdiction for county fairs and some of the funding for it. But it has not had increases for many years. I believe the last time it was actually increased in terms of the base funding was 1988. So it's been a long time since there's been any increase in this. In state statute, there is a section under Chapter 38 that specifically states how the state is intended to fund the money that does go to the county fairs, and it's designated by the exhibitors that are there. I will tell you that over the years I have scratched my head many times to come up with a better way of doing it, but since the basis and the core of fairs is the exhibitors, I have not come up with anything that's better than that. But what it basically does is it says that the first $750 worth of premiums that are paid to exhibitors and so forth is to be funded at 100%, and then there's a diminishing distribution rate within the statute. In order to fund at the rate that the statute says is intended to be funded, I asked Mr. Knopf if he would assist in getting that information for you, and the number that is in the bill is the highest rate in the recent years that would have been required under the funding formula. The funding formula statute designates that if there is not enough funding, that it will be prorated, and so that is what's been happening. This is not a large portion of the funding for most fairs, but in many cases it may designate anywhere from 5 to 10%. It can be in that range in terms of money that comes into the fairs. Fairs have had many challenges in the last number of years, and I guess today as we take a look at this, I would ask you as senators to kind of buy into three or four different items. First of all, I would hope that you believe that fairs are valuable instruments in the community. They're one of the last places, I think, where urban and rural interests come together and interface in a positive way. Secondly, that they are also important financial pieces of the community, not only in terms of the county fairs, that they do contribute financially to the community and to the state coffers through sales tax and payroll taxes and so forth, more money by far than what is done in this appropriation, and that they are a good value in those contributions. And lastly, that the state should live up to the statutory commitment that is you've had on the books for a number of years. If you were to take a look at the total situation that most fairs are in, you'll find that most of them, for the fair itself, do not make a profit. That's why even very small amounts of money that are brought into them, whether it be by local governments or by the state of Minnesota, is very important to them. A little bit like looking at the state treasury when you're only $1 billion short. You're still $1 billion short. And that's kind of the situation with a lot of fairs. And part of that is also, I want to point out, that it's because of challenges that have been brought on by policies of this legislature. For instance, a few years ago, there was a mandate passed by this legislature to include safety bleachers that cost most fairs many thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars in almost every case, and hundreds of thousands, I think, in some cases. So there are some things. Secondly, there has been a cut in local government aids, as most of you know. I know that some of you are trying to restore those. What does that mean to county fairs? It means that local counties, townships, cities, and so forth that used to be able to put more money into those fairs are putting less money into them because of the cuts that they had to assume. And so in most cases in recent years, there has been reductions in the local effort. And other types of increased mandates, such as increased requirements for security at the fairs, handicap accessibility that's been mandated both by state and federal. In the case of, we've had many situations where, for instance, the beer garden, which quite frankly at many county fairs is one of the big fundraising events, is now required to do things like put up fences and extra kinds of things where it used to maybe was a, at one time it probably was a corn crib fence, is now required to have chain-linked, cement-in-place type fences by local communities and so forth for that control. And beyond that, such things as state food inspections and increased, quite frankly, increased audits and participation by our Department of Revenue, making sure that the sales taxes are paid by the fairs and so forth, that right or wrong in the past, maybe we're a little more lax than what we see today. So because of that, there are many challenges. In addition to that, many fairs are being challenged by the fact that the usage of those entities is being challenged, and this affects their income. As an example, we had a situation a number of years ago in which in the Anoka County area, a local fair had agreed, I think, with like a Hertz rental car type situation to let them use that as a staging area, the interior of their racetrack and so forth as a staging area. The problem is that the Anoka County Fair, when it was built 100 years ago or so, was probably a very highly valued entity in Anoka. But today, when there are $500,000 homes built all the way around it, it's a little less valued in that same capacity. So because of that, local cities and so forth, in this particular case, the city of Anoka, tried to restrict the usage of that. We did have some legislation a couple of years ago to give some advantage to the fairs in defending themselves against those types of restrictions, but they do continue to happen. Fees are also increasing from local units of government, whether it's building permits or whether it's fees for water. In many cases, we see situations recently where the county fair used to receive free water from the city, no longer does. Now there's a water gauge out there to determine that and so forth. So these kinds of things are things that are changing, and the need for the income becomes even greater than it has in the past. The last thing I'd say is also that it's changing in terms of the people. Competition for entertainment dollars. In addition to that, such things as extension cuts. The University of Minnesota has made a number of extension cuts in recent years. In some cases, because 4-H is such a vital, important part of these fairs, the fairs themselves actually fund part of the extension program locally that they did not used to have to do in order to keep the 4-H kids involved in it. And so those are some of the kind of broad issues that I have. I do have with me today, if you're interested at all in talking to people from particular fairs, Wally Wickman, who is one of our board of directors, and also Joe Skopansky, who is also from board of directors, one from Benton and one from Lyon County down in your area, Mr. Chairman. We do have some handouts, I think, that we put out that give you some indication as to how the funds have come in. These are old figures. They're from the year 2003, so they're a little out of date, but it does give you some general idea. The one figure on that page of the yellow sheets that you have that is significantly out of date, I think, is the Department of Revenue sales tax items, because they've gotten a lot tougher on collecting in the last couple of years. So I think that number is significantly higher than what it had been. And the last point I would make is that, as Senator Skoy had indicated, the state fair brings in $1.5 million worth of sales tax during the state fair, and an additional $150 million worth of economic enterprise in the Twin City area during the state fair. Without county fairs, you don't have state fair. And so I guess that's the pitch to you. We would hope that you would be able to find it within your power to meet at least a small need, and to at least meet the appropriation that would fully fund the provisions that are in the statute and have been for some time.
Well, Mr. Schoenfeld and members of the committee, I represent six counties down in the southwest corner. The big important part of the whole year is the county fair. Mm-hmm. Everybody goes to county fair. They're all there. And they start on, they even come on Wednesday, which used to be a day that you kind of took livestock in. Now that gets to be one of the big days. The most important part about, I think about it, it teaches the youngsters how to take care of animals, and it isn't easy. They clean them and scrub them and walk them, and it's they have quite a time. But I think that's one thing that we can do when we're in greater Minnesota, and I'm sure they here they probably do the same. But it's an entertainment, and it's a learning process. It's not easy. You think you got the blue ribbon calf and the blue ribbon steer, and you get a red, it kind of takes you down, but you have to learn that somebody else had one a little bit better than you do. It's a learning process, too. Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I was just going to mention that Mr. Schoenfeld mentioned all the things that have increased costs for county fairs, all the different government requirements, inspections, and fence requirements, and so on. Well, you mentioned tax audits. which reminded me of my experience on the Meeker County Fair Board. I was on it for 18 years and chairman for a couple of years, and we were notified that they want to do a tax audit on our books. So we asked them, where do you want to meet? And they said, well, how about the fair office? Well, we thought that was a good location because it was in the dead of winter, sub-zero temperature, no heat. And so we sat in there with our heavy jackets on, and this tax auditor, after trying to add up a few numbers and look at a few pieces of paper, decided things were okay and decided to go on.
Senator Wiggins.
Mr. Chair, if anyone thinks county fairs aren't important to the people of an area, just sit on a county board once when there's an attempt to move a county fair from one city to another. I might add that was about 8 years ago, and it still hasn't been decided whether it should move or not. But I was looking at this sheet, and I kind of like that. Just seeing that there are actually 95 county fairs, obviously some counties have two for sure. And I like the fact that if you look at 2,764,000 people attending, that's, you know, could be called half of the state's population attending a county fair. But we also, when we give them 495,000, we get, I'd say by this time, better than half of that back in sales tax. I think it's a pretty good deal for the state.
Senator Dill, I've noticed over the years at fairs, lately now, sheep have come a great part of fairs now, more maybe than big steers, and they have. Another thing that's happening out there, goats. Who used to think about goats? But there's a lot of high-priced fancy goats coming into the fair. So it's a good plus. Nothing else. I'll go way back in history. Kind of nice place to take your girlfriend.
Mr. Chairman?
I think somebody speaks from experience.
You know, I had a bad experience taking a girlfriend to the county fair.
I don't know if you want
it was,
to know.
It was my wife. One of our first dates, and she wanted to go in the tilt-a-whirl. Mm-hmm. And I got on this doggone thing with her, and the guy that was running it turned it on, and then he started reading a comic book. Forgot all about it. And I couldn't hold the Pronto Pup down any longer.
Senator Wiggins, do you have another?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just going to mention that in my area, horses have become just a huge part of our county fairs.
Senator Engelbertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm going to do the total funding except for the tilt-a-whirl, so I'm in favor of that.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Oh, boy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems county fairs must hit close to the heart here. You get a lot of input from the committee. But I know personally that they really, really struggle with their local budgets. And I know the Winona County Fair runs on a shoestring, which I imagine is pretty much what everyone else's county fair does. And for many years, I've helped with the 4-H judging program as a Minnesota Master Gardener. I go in and do the hort and fruit and vegetable section for the 4-H entries. And then I typically donate back my check to the county board because they just have not very much money at all. So whatever we can do to support, I think that would be a great investment.
Any other questions? Mr. Schoenfeld, maybe you should have your two people just stand up. They don't need to come to the table, but...
I'm Lonnie Wakeman from Lyon County. Vice President of the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs is coming here.
Okay.
And I'm Joe Skopansky. I represent District 6, which takes in St. Paul and the greater vicinity.
Okay. Senator Scoy, why don't you do a bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, in my opening, I talked about the state fair and the wonderful community gathering that is. But, you know, as those of us sitting here as legislators, I would bet most, if not all of us, attend a number of county fairs through the summertime. I actually have eight counties that I go to. I do go to all the county fairs. And, you know, you see the community involvement. You see the young kids at the 4-H showing their animals or whatever their exhibits are. It's just a great thing. I would certainly hope that we could find some resources to fund continuation. And, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File number 496 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the agriculture omnibus bill.
On the Scoy motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. We have another one, Senator Skoy, and that's 497.
Mr. Chair and members, here with Senate File, third bill, Senate File number 496. Senate File 497 is a bill to appropriate money to the Minnesota Agriculture Education Leadership Council. This council was started in 1997 with funding of $350,000. And they've had no increases in that time. They've actually decreased to $260,000 a year. They do a lot of really good work for agriculture and for children. And I'm here with Julie Tesh and Jerry Schoenfeld, and I think Ms. Tesh is going to talk about all the great things that this Leadership Council is doing for Minnesotans and Minnesota kids. And so I'll turn it over to her.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Vickerman and Senator, members of the committee. My name is Julie Tesh, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, otherwise referred to as MLC. And actually, first, Mr. Schoenfeld is going to talk to you a little bit about our background and our history.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I worked with the creation of this council in 1997, and the lead senator at that time was Senator Dal Sams, who was the chief author at that time, and also Senator Stumpf. And since that time, Senator Dill has served on the MLC board. Senator Vickerman, you are now the new chair to be on the MLC board, and a number of other people that have been in this area. I think one of the questions that might be asked first is why would a Ag Education Leadership Council funding provision be looked at in the Ag Finance Committee versus an Education Committee as an example? And I want to give you a little bit of the scope of this. Agricultural education, first of all, I'm actually going to read the definition here a little bit. Agricultural education is a systematic program of instruction available to students desiring to learn about the science, business, and technology of plant and animal production and or about the environment and natural resources systems. The reason I want to point that out was because people tend to think of most education as classes. We have a class in English, we have a class in math, we have a class in science, and so forth. Ag education is a bit more encompassing in that, and its tradition has been more encompassing in that, and it's an interdisciplinary type of a system of education, and it covers three different areas, on the high school level at least, in the fact that it is not only classroom instruction, but it also includes, for instance, the FFA, which is the opportunity for students to use an intracurricular-based organization to do what we used to call outcome-based learning, where students were able to not only learn in the classroom, but then go out and exhibit their skills in that area through the competition between schools in terms of the FFA. It also includes the supervised agricultural experience, which is like an internship. The reason I point this out is because some of the dimensions of ag education go beyond what you would typically think is just classroom learning for most subjects. Why in the Ag Finance Committee? Well, first of all, in terms of ag education, if you take a look at careers, there are over 300 related careers in Minnesota that are related to agricultural education. 350,000 jobs in Minnesota relate to agriculture. That's more jobs than 3M, Target, and Northwest Airlines combined. So when you look at this committee and you look at resources that you apply through funding in this committee, you apply those resources, whether it's through AURI or whether it's funding that might go into a tuberculosis thing with the Board of Animal Health. These are all resources going into agriculture. One of those additional resources is agricultural education itself. Beyond just the high school, and this is a key component of why MLC exists, you also have approximately 100 instructors in this state that deal with farm business management that is high school level, or not beyond high school level, I meant to say, in the MNSCU system. And you, in addition to that, have four 2+2 systems between MNSCU, the community college system, and the University of Minnesota, for instance. But the only place you can get a degree in agricultural education in Minnesota is at the University of Minnesota. And because of that, what I've just described is a system that covers not only high school, but covers MNSCU, the University of Minnesota, and goes beyond that into agri-literacy for all the people of the state. Because of that, MLC was established in order to look at how to bring all these disparate parts together. The Department of Education, for instance, did not used to know what the Minsky system was doing in ag education. The University of Minnesota didn't know what Minsky was doing and so forth. All of the disparate parts come together under the MLC board. The other unique thing about the MLC board is its flexibility. It is a task-oriented board in the sense that there are certain things that must be achieved and go across these different disciplines and go across the different educational institutions. And it is the MLC board that helps bring that together. As an example, when the MLC board was originated in 1997, one of the first tasks that was put before it was the fact that the University of Minnesota was not graduating students in agricultural education. At that time, at the time this bill passed, there were only 6 students that graduated in ag education that spring. We've had a 300-fold increase since that time. Now it's up to 18. That may seem not a lot to you, but we now have 130 students in the pipeline. We have 50 graduate students. We have 4 instructors that are professors at the University of Minnesota in ag education, whereas the time that this passed, there was a half-time instructor and 6 students. So we've made dramatic increases in terms of the ability to provide those. What does that mean to the high schools? Well, the reasons that many of the agricultural education programs in the high schools were diminishing in those days was because they couldn't find an instructor to teach them. There simply was no instructors to teach the class, so the educational program in the local high school went away. MLC took that upon themselves as one of their first tasks to deal with. A second issue is the fact that if you went to the College of Agriculture, for instance, at the University of Minnesota, you will find that over half the students are not from farm background. They are not from rural areas. They are from the Twin Cities. They are people that that are in many cases now are coming from the agricultural high school out of Chicago, for instance, where and the inner city students, over 90% of their students inner city. And part of the task that was also taken up early on by the MLC board was to create an opportunity for students in the Twin City metro area to do the same thing that we had in 185 districts across the state in rural schools. So the Agricultural Academy of Food and Sciences was created at Van Nuys Heights. It's a state charter school in agricultural education that today has about 220 students, all of which come from the 7-county metro area, most of them from Minneapolis and St. Paul. And they learn agriculture, none of which know anything about it when they start there, but 40% of which go on to go into college-level areas in agriculture. And in addition to that, they have a 92% retention rate there, which is way higher than the other schools that exist in that same general metropolitan area. So they've done some good things. There are many other things I think that Julie could speak to. But my point being that when money is asked for the MLC board, it is not it is an opportunity where the board examines it. And I think one of the great advantages is the diversity of where that board comes from and the integration of all the different parts that exist here with ag education and all the different educational institutions and other things that come together. And so with that, maybe, Mr. Chairman, I could turn back to Julie to talk a little bit more about some of the other areas that they've been involved in and then get to the funding itself.
All right, Mr. Chair, I encourage you to look at the handouts that were provided for you. There is our most recent newsletter in there, and on that you'll see we do have a scholarship program, number one, but also more importantly a grants program. This year we have $90,000 available for our grants program, and you'll see in our first round, actually what we've done is we've split it into 2 rounds so that it's easier for teachers to apply for funding throughout their curriculum year. And so on the front page of our newsletter, you'll see our first round of grant winners. And what we've also done is we've realigned our grants program. We have what is now called priority issues grants, and we have specified priority issues with recruitment, retention, integrating science, math, and economics into our agricultural curriculum. And so we've really focused on that in our grants program. And there's also a summary of accomplishments with that as well, talking about what we've accomplished just in the past year's MLC. And finally, there should be a very colorful packet that actually references this CD right here, which I believe Mr. Schoenfeld will talk about in a little bit. But this is our natural resource science curriculum. We are very proud of this curriculum. We've worked with the Department of Education and also with MNSCU. And that packet there just gives you a little oversight of what this curriculum can do. What can happen is each teacher in agricultural education can use this CD, and it will focus on what standards, strands, lesson plans, tests, everything. It'll do the whole thing for you so the teacher doesn't have to research, and it takes you out on the web as well. So we're very proud of this, and this is one of three. We're working on animal science, and we're also working on plant science. Those are the three areas, including natural resource science, the top three areas taught in secondary agricultural education programs. So I encourage you to look at that at your leisure. MEAL-C, like Jerry said, is a 16-member legislative council. We were created in 1997, and we were originally an initiative of the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators. The problem addressed, obviously, is Minnesota is a leading state in agriculture, yet we face a critical shortage of agriculture students, teachers, and well-trained workers. Our membership, just so you can understand who our members are, and we rely on our members heavily. They are the ones who decide who receives scholarships, who receives grants. Our non-legislative members decide that. But our membership, our co-chairs, are Representative Mary Ellen Otremba and Senator Vickerman. Then we also have Tom Apple, who is an ag teacher out of Mountain Lake, Minnesota, Jim Borboom with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Al Brutley with MinSCU, he is a farm business management instructor, Kevin Dahlman, who is a governor's appointment from the Dassel area, Senator Steve Dill, who's on this board. It's a pleasure working with him. Daryl Hartle, the head of the Ag Ed Department at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Al Levine, Dean of the College of Ag at the University of Minnesota. Dan Smith with the Minnesota Department of Education. Gary Tomey, who is a farm business management instructor in the Austin area. Senator Leroy Stumpf, and also Cliff Fries, who's a governor's appointment from the Truman area. Talking about funding, our original allocation was $300,000, and we are now, with budget cuts and everything, we are down to $266,000. We are housed at the University of Minnesota, St. Paul campus. We're right in with the agricultural education faculty, which is an asset and which sometimes isn't. But it's great to be able to have that cross-pollination, knowing what's going on in the post-secondary world and being able to transfer that into what we do. And being housed at the University of Minnesota, we follow all of their rules and regulations. We pay their IRS fee, their taxes, and so that tax for us is about $24,000. So when I get down to my budget every year, I have about $242,000 to work with. Typically in the past, at least a third of that goes towards our strategic grants programs. And so we've been really scraping by trying to award those grants and scholarships to people. And with that, actually, I will focus just a little bit more at the University of Minnesota. We have had a 300% increase in students. And like Mr. Schoenfeld said, yes, it might not seem like a lot going from 6 graduates to 18. But let me tell you that out in the field of school administrators, being able to actually have a pool of applicants to choose from is wonderful. And this year, actually, we had 18 student teachers going out last week. They're doing their practice teaching. And the things that they're able to do, we're encouraging them to work with science teachers, math teachers, and economics teachers. So it's a wonderful thing. And maybe they don't go into teaching, but at least they have an appreciation and understanding of agriculture and what it does for our state and can go on to teach other people informally. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Schoenfeld.
I just would like to finish just by giving you a little relationship here. When this program was started in 1997, as most things around the legislature go, the original drawn-up proposal was for $6 million. It received $1 million in funding. It was described that a portion of that goes to MEAL-C directly. The other $650,000 went to the University of Minnesota to improve the Ag Education Department. So when you're looking at this, you have to put a little in that context. It was fashioned after a program that was at in the state of Illinois that had about a $6 million funding program there. And it is the flexibility, as I said before, that provides for this. It seems perhaps like this is a significant increase in their funding, and it is because we're asking for an additional $1 million for the biennium. But so many of the things that were intended to be done, many of them were done on a shoestring and were done very well. I'll give you one example of that. The teacher induction program that was started by MEAL-C and working with the University of Minnesota Ag Ed Department was done for 10 years now in ag education. What the induction program is a way to retain teachers once they get into the profession by providing them with assistance in the field so that they don't get scared out in their first year. It's worked very effectively. We've had significant increases in retention because of it. The governor this year proposes $4.4 million in his education budget to copy what we did with the teacher induction program and put it available to the rest of the teachers in the state. There are many success stories like that in what was done, and it was done on a shoestring in large part because of the hard work of all the membership that was involved. But at the same time, the dream, at least, that was started back then with the idea that we would add another $1 million down the road and another million after that and so forth, to get to a $6 million figure to do all the different programs that we're hoping to do, never happened because of all the budget cuts in the last 10 years. So it's probably the only program that you're looking at, other than maybe county fairs, that has gotten no increases since 1997 whatsoever, actually decreases, and the output has been pretty amazing.
Members, any questions? Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd just like to say I've been on this Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council since the beginning, and I've been very impressed with the amount of progress that was made. You've heard from the witnesses that there's been a lot of successes and progress, and I just want to confirm that. It's been great. And without Melcy, Ag Education probably would be really down the tube by now.
Any other questions? Senator Scoy, look, the way I read it, I'm asking for $500,000 in year 2008 and then $500,000 in year 2009. Am I reading it right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you are reading that correctly. And let me just real briefly say, Mr. Schoenfeld talked about the interdisciplinary nature of ag education now. And really, ag committee members, I'd like you to think that that's really reflective of what it's like to be in agriculture. And you're, as a farmer, you work with science and math and soils and business and kinds of things. So it's real important for agriculture to have this type of leadership council there, working with the education institutions, and ask for your support on this. And Mr. Chair, I would, if I could, move Senate File number 497 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus ag bill.
Any other discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. We have one last bill.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I'll get right to the point on this bill. The Rural Finance Authority partners with local lenders to provide affordable credit to eligible farmers. Loan participations are purchased by the RFA. I know what the RFA, maybe some other people do not, so I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Jim Borbloom if you'll just discuss the loan program and how it works.
Mr. Borbloom.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Borbloom, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. My remarks will be primarily on the nature of the program, how the program does work, and I know that you've got other witnesses here to talk about the value or the impact of the program to their borrowers. The Rural Finance Authority was established in 1986. It was established during a time when there was a lot of financial adversity in the rural economies, and lenders were looking for ways to deal with loans that were terribly unsecured and were not cash flowing. And so the state of Minnesota created the Rural Finance Authority. The model of the Rural Finance Authority is that the state or the RFA will essentially purchase a participation interest in a real estate loan originated by an ag lender. The portion of the loan that is carried by the state of Minnesota or by the Rural Finance Authority is offered at a discount or a lower rate of interest. The other benefit to the borrower, besides having a cash flow advantage because of the lower interest rate, is that the program provides access to credit. Lenders that originate these loans, a lot of them are to beginning farmers or farmers who are maybe looking to upgrade or improve their building sites. And because the lender can share the loan or share the risk with the state of Minnesota, it makes it easier for them to grant that credit. The bond authorization, proposal that's in Senate File 227 authorizes the Rural Finance Authority, or I should say the Department of Finance, to sell bonds on behalf of the Rural Finance Authority. The RFA uses the proceeds from those bonds to buy the participation interest in five different loan programs. There are two programs that are directed toward beginning farmers. There's a basic and seller assisted program. The Rural Finance Authority would buy up to $200,000 of a loan. There's an agriculture improvement program where the RFA would buy up to $200,000 in that one as well. Then there is what's called a livestock expansion loan program that is for an existing farmer, established one with a livestock enterprise. And under that program, they can do an upgrade or modernization of a dairy or hog or any livestock enterprise. And then the fifth program that is offered by the Rural Finance Authority is really our first one that was started, and that is a restructure program where a farmer who is having trouble with cash flow, maybe because of a drought or a flood or a tornado or some event like that, not able to pay bills, has equity in real estate, can refinance the real estate, again, sell a portion of that loan to the state of Minnesota and get a lower interest rate. One of the unique things about the program is that it is user financed. The Rural Finance Authority, once it sells bonds, take the cash proceeds from the sale of the bonds and buy a portion of that real estate loan originated by an ag lender. We carry those loans for 10 years, and during that time we collect some interest earnings. We also collect principal and interest payments on those loan participations. Those receipts are deposited into a dedicated account, and the Department of Finance annually sweeps that dedicated account then to repay the debt service on the bonds. And over the history of the program, actually the state of Minnesota has authorized the sale of more than $140 million in bond authorization. We have paid back $124 million in bonds through, again, the principal and interest receipts. And at the present time, we have about $53 million in outstanding loans at the present time. And through the course of the program, we've serviced or given some financial support to more than 2,900 Minnesota farmers. The unique thing about it, besides, again, being the fact that we do pay back the debt service on the bonds, is that this is a partnership. We do not compete with existing lenders. We are a strong partner with those lenders. And you can hear a couple of them this afternoon talk about the value of the program. And we have, again, more than 400 participation agreements with them. I'll close with those remarks.
Mr. Chair, I have two other people I'd like to have come up and say a few words, and then I'll go a little bit more into the bill, if that'd be okay.
That'd be great.
John, David.
I think I'm the first to go. Mr. Chairman, my name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and we represent Farm Credit Services, the Farm Credit Services serving Minnesota at the Minnesota Legislature. Just very quickly, for a little bit of background on Farm Credit. Farm Credit, there are four associations in Minnesota which are by federal law required to provide credit throughout the state and throughout the country. So we're in every county in the state and every state in the nation. The four associations are known to you perhaps as AgStar, which is kind of two-thirds of the state, southern Minnesota and the eastern side of the state, Ag Country, which is out of Moorhead, kind of the west and the north area, Farm Credit Services of Minnesota Valley, which is over in the Willmar area, the central part of the state, and then Farm Credit Services of Grand Forks, which is in the northwestern part of the state. It's we're a federally chartered agricultural lender that is cooperatively owned by our borrowers. In Minnesota, there's about 30,000 borrowers, and the assets or the loans outstanding are about $3 billion. It's truly a pleasure to support the chairman's bill and to encourage you to move this forward as quickly as you can. Farm Credit has been a strong supporter and a strong user, an originator of rural finance loans almost since its inception, which is goes back to the mid-'80s, when there was a real problem in the state in agriculture. And the state responded, lenders responded, and we've worked through a lot of tough spots and made agriculture in the state a much, much healthier industry. But what the program does for normal lenders like us and the independent bankers that you'll hear from in a moment is allows us to make credit available to people who might not otherwise be able to meet some of the repayment requirements of a regular loan. In Minnesota, in 2005, Farm Credit made about 30 loans through this program for roughly $3 million. In 2006, we made about 21 loans for about $2.2 million, and we've got loan applications pending. Short of the story is we ran out of money in July. And this was something that came on quite quickly. The use of the program was really pressed in the early part of last year. And it was at the end of the session that we kind of learned that there wasn't sufficient resources available going into the summer and the fall to probably deal with all of the applications that were going to come forward. But unfortunately, we were in the throes of the end of the session and essentially weren't able to get the Rural Finance Authority replenished in time to go into the next year. So we've kind of had applications out there pending since about July of last year. So I'm going to encourage you to do something a little bit unusual with this bill, if you will. If you take a look at this bill, it's requesting $15 million, and we applaud the chairman on that, $15 million in revenue bonds sold by the state to replenish the resources of the RFA. And what's unusual about this program that I think Mr. Beerbohm indicated is that the bonds are paid back not from the general fund, but the bonds are paid back from the repayments made by the borrowers. So it doesn't go against the bond limit, and it doesn't go against your budget limits. It's a, if you will, sort of a freestanding program that we'd encourage you to move forward passing this bill and authorizing this borrowing as quickly as possible. Now, of course, this bill has to arise in the House, but you all can sure send a message by moving this thing to the floor as quickly as you can, laying it on the table and saying, come on over and meet us, if you will, House members. There are applications pending. We are going into a planting season. There are people who could use and do need these resources, and we're just here to encourage you to move quickly. The chairman's got a good bill here, and we'd hope you'd act on it quite quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Appetz. Senator Engelbretson?
Just one question, Mr. Chair. This is the old PCA, Production Credit
Association. Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Senator Engelbretson.
That's all I have.
Yes, sir. And federal land banks.
Senator Kubley?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who to address it to, but does anybody know if the sale of bonds here would count against the state's self-imposed bonding limit?
You want to? Mr. Borboom?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, know that it does not. The bond programs are totally user-financed, and we're able to fully repay the debt service on those bonds.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, these are revenue bonds as opposed to general obligation bonds, and the general obligation bonds are where you have the 3% limit.
Members of the committee, we have a comment from Mr. Knopf on this subject.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Appetz, these are still general obligation bonds. I mean, the full faith and credit of the state is still being employed to back the bonds to get the better interest rate. They are they're kind of a hybrid. They're not the revenue is used to repay the bonds, but they still are general. I just wanted to clear up that they still are general obligation bonds because the full faith and credit of the state does back these bonds.
Well,
does that affect his question?
Well, no, or does it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kubley, as I understand it, the 3% cap is a self-imposed cap by the state, and it deals with money that comes out of the general fund to pay off bonds, not user finance bonds. These are user finance bonds.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, then we'll go to Mr. David Skillbred, Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, members, David Skillbred, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, a statewide association of independently held community-focused commercial banks throughout our state. We, too, would like to thank Chairman Vickerman and the Department of Agriculture and all of you for supporting this program in the past and for supporting this bill today. I would like to also encourage you to consider the possibility of fast-tracking this bill to the degree possible that you could. We have members in rural, suburban, and urban communities but the majority of our members are in rural Minnesota, and this is a very popular program for our members and for the customers that we serve. We've had several discussions about the RFA at our committee level, and almost each time it comes up, my members are complimentary of the program and the staff and the way that it is implemented in our state. Late this fall, when I was preparing for the legislative session, I did a non-scientific survey amongst my members and included a few questions about the program and the fact that some of these programs had been, in effect, frozen due to the high demand that was not projected or foreseen prior to the appropriations in the past. And one thing that came out amongst my unscientific survey was that about 30% of the RFA-authorized lenders who completed my survey stated that eligible customers for some of these loan programs were waiting or changing plans due to the lack of funding. In light of that, I think that it would be very good for those individuals to not only fund this again this year, but to try to do so as soon as possible so that those folks who are in the waiting category can get on with their business. It's a very positive program, and again, we'd like to thank the chairman and the department for working so hard on this, and we support Senate File 227.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any questions from the committee or comments? Senator Gimsey?
Mr. Chairman and panel, a number of us have heard the horror stories of us giving authority for bonds, but the slow response in getting those bonds sold and moving them along. Do you see any problem that way as far as the immediacy of getting them sold? And
Mr. Barboom?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, the mechanism that we have, the Rural Finance Authority, is an 11-member board made up of five agency head and six public members. The mechanism that we work with, we have a very close working relationship with the Department of Finance. Whenever there is a loan demand or enough sufficient demand to sell bonds, we essentially size the sale of the bond depending on when finance sells their bonds. They usually have three bond sales in an 18-month time frame, and so we try to match up the timing of those bond sales with our loan demand. Our experience has been very good. We have not had any problems or delays.
Thank you.
Does the committee
members
have any... Senator Vickerman.
We choose to go this way by working with the finance department to see how we could get the money there faster rather than go through the process. And I think there's a way you can do it. I believe they can, finance can speed this up. I believe I'm right. Am I right, Mr. Borbo? We need that money like now because we're out.
Senator Borbo or Mr. Borbo?
It'll be another day, I think. Mr. Chairman, I do know that once the legislature grants authorization to sell bonds, we can go ahead and reopen the program. Even though the Department of Finance may not sell right away, we can essentially borrow against the general fund in order to meet the loan demand. We can't borrow any more than what the Department of Finance is going to sell, and I think there is a cap, the amount of tax-exempt bonds that could be sold. So the simple answer is we can immediately reopen the program once the legislature grants authorization and then just simply pay it back. Once we get the cash proceeds from the bond sale, we just simply pay back the general fund.
Well, Mr. Chair, if there's no more questions, I would move, or I would recommend that Senate File 227 be passed and has to go to the Senate Finance Committee, and that's the stop it has to go to from here. So I will make that motion, and we'll see what happens.
Is there any discussion on Senator Vickerman's motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion's carried.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Senator Vickerman, do you have any announcements or anything before we adjourn? Okay, then the meeting's adjourned.